Welcome to Recovering Evangelicals, a podcast for people who were once very comfortable in the Christian faith until the 21st century intruded and made it very hard to keep on believing. I'm your host, Luke Jansen.
And I'm Scott Dyer.
This podcast is aimed at evangelicals and evangelicalism, but it doesn't seek to only cast either of those in a negative light, as so many other podcasts seem to do. It's easy to point out all the problems with evangelicalism and its followers, to reduce the movement to ashes, to lampoon its leaders, marginalize the followers. But our goal is recovery. It's in the name. Looking for where the movement seems to have taken a path that makes it irrelevant to society, and finding ways to get back onto a better path, and creating a community of people helping each other to regain a personal identity, a worldview that will look very different from their evangelical past, even though it might still be a religious view or not. So we're a podcast for people who are recovering from evangelicalism and a podcast trying to recover what's still good in evangelicalism.
Yeah, absolutely. And, we've talked about this before, but we've been a little more focused on kind of the deconstruction aspect of things. But we also need to balance that with, okay, so how do we reconstruct? And, you know, can we reconstruct? What do we reconstruct? You know, in a lot of ways, that's a much more difficult. It's always easier to tear things down, right?
Yes.
Than to build them up. So,
yes,
for sure.
But we're working on it.
We're working on it. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the steps that evangelicalism has taken, and it seems to be a conscious decision that is making it increasingly irrelevant to society, is its shunning of intellectualism. We've talked often about young earth creationism and its denial of so much science, sometimes to the point of absurdity, and their efforts to create a bubble, an echo chamber around their children so that those kids won't ever be exposed to the new ideas from science. We've also looked at how evangelicals shun philosophy, dismissing it all as a foolishness of man, and closing their ears to anything good that we can learn from other world religions. We've talked to Kristen Cobez-Dumais, author of Jesus and John Wayne. We've talked to Frankie Schaefer and Philip Yancey and many other lesser-known authors and historians about evangelicals getting involved with politics, American politics to be precise, which took the evangelical brand to newer levels of a paradoxical mixture of notoriety and irrelevance, unfortunately. And all of those episodes and many others were influenced by a particular book that was written 30 years ago. Its title, The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind by Dr. Mark Knoll. Scott, did you read that book?
Absolutely.
Yeah, when?
As soon as it came out, I forget when it was published, but I think in the 90s.
94.
94. Well, yeah. The second day out, I probably read. Yeah, I remember reading it right away. Yeah.
So you must have heard, like, you anticipated this. You heard something good about it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I've been reading Mark Knoll for a long time because he's an excellent historian and really the premier historian of Christianity in the U.S. and Canada, and particularly evangelical Christianity, but not just that. I've been reading him for many years, and when I heard about the book, it was a no-brainer for me, and I ate it up. If I remember back, I read it probably in a few sittings, you know?
Wow.
Yeah.
You couldn't put it down.
Couldn't put it down. It wasn't that long, particularly long book, but when I think back on it, I was quite encouraged at the time. I thought this is great that this is being said, because I have fought all my Christian journey against the anti-intellectual strand within particularly evangelical Christian expression. But, you know, even more broadly than that, just in general, you know, the religious mindset just tends to have an anti-intellectual bent.
And it's interesting, you said you were encouraged after reading the book. When I read it, I was actually a bit dismayed. I'm not trying to be funny. I'm honest.
But you would have a different perspective because you've seen what's gone on in your intervening years, I guess.
Right. And the one thing that he said that really it made me stop and think about it, he said that it's beyond evangelicals themselves to move ahead in these scholarly intellectual circles. And they can go ahead, but they're going to make progress on the backs of Roman Catholics and Greek Orthodox. That's where the progress is going to be made, and evangelicals will reap the rewards of that. But it's going to come from those other circles and not their own.
Yeah. Now, remember, that's a long time ago.
And 30 years ago.
30 years ago. I do think that I think there's been huge progress since he wrote the book. And I think his book is responsible for some of that progress. You know, it was okay. Kind of a clarion call. But if you look at the modern kind of university scene and publishing as well, there's a pretty strong representation now of Christian people, whether they're evangelical, you know, quote or not, but Christian people. Alvin Plantinga comes to mind, you know, one of the top philosophers in the United States, not just a religious philosopher, but top philosopher, period. You know, he's right. Recognized as, and he that's just one example of penetrating that glass ceiling.
Right. That book has been mentioned so many times on this podcast, and it's always in the background, unmentioned in so many of our episodes. Today, we're going to talk to the author of that book, again, Dr. Mark Allen Knoll. Dr. Knoll is a historian with an emphasis on the history of Christianity in the U.S. and Canada, and is thoroughly evangelical, with training at Wheaton College, the University of Iowa, Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, and Vanderbilt University. He's a prolific author with nearly 36 book titles to his name, and he was awarded a National Humanities Medal in the Oval Office by President George W. Bush in 2006. And to cap all of that off, he's here in our studio today. Dr. Knoll, Mark, if I may, welcome sure. to our podcast.
Oh, thank you, and thank you for the invitation.
This is a thrill for me. You know, our audience may sense this, but my participation in this podcast is mostly because I get to meet so many of my heroes, and Dr. Knoll is one of them. I've been highly influenced by his many books over the years, and I love history, and I've just really appreciated his whole delving into the history of evangelicalism, both in Canada and the U.S., which is great.
Oh, thank you.
So, Mark, you are an evangelical, a very personally committed one, and you have impeccable credentials within evangelical academia, even though you've been at times in the past very critical of the evangelical movement. So tell us a bit about your journey through the evangelical movement.
I was raised in a Baptist church in Iowa and have come to appreciate greatly the fidelity of the people that were responsible, my parents and the people in the church. I probably didn't take too kindly to some of the fundamentalist evangelical ways of doing things. I was an undergraduate at Wheaton College and certainly enjoyed as a kind of participant observer of what was happening, but it was only after graduating, partly through the contacts that came from the woman that I would marry, my wife now, Maggie Packer Knoll, as she is, who was a conservative Presbyterian. So I started reading a little bit about the Reformation and the history of Protestantism and found particularly not so much with the Reformed people, but with Martin Luther, a really strong and effective and convicting, but also reassuring presentation of the Christian gospel as first grace in God's mercy shown on the cross of Christ, and then for the Christian life following. Then after that, I've gravitated toward Reformed varieties of Protestantism because of the sense of mercy and grace that is at the bottom of I think, all Christian movements, but then also because the Reformed certainly had a tradition of serious attention to the created world and then the processes that undermine creation and the processes that could make it whole or make it better. So, yeah, I guess I've been sort of an evangelical, but also very much appreciating other strands of Christian faith. I was privileged toward the end of my career to teach 10 years at the University of Notre Dame. And even before then, but certainly while there, came away much, much more soundly and positively impressed with the love of God, the love of Christ, the ability to do things with the mind and in the world and found in many, many Catholic situations. And I would say part of the great fun of being a historian is to encounter a lot of people who weren't necessarily in my particular ecclesiastical slot, but whom I could admire a great deal. So people say, well, who do you admire historically? Sometimes it's Mennonites, sometimes it's people from the Orthodox world, sometimes it's Pentecostals, sometimes it's even a few Presbyterians, which is my particular combination. So I think one of the values of being a historian is that you see that Christian profession is important, but Christian action and Christian attitudes may be even more important. And I guess that's it. Why I'm pleased to be called an evangelical, but I'm also eager to learn from other Christian groups and as all Christian groups, I think, should do, not afraid to be critical when I think criticism is necessary.
So, Mark, let's talk about the book itself, The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind. And not just because it comes up so often in our podcast episodes, it's particularly because this is the 30th anniversary of its printing. In 1995, Christianity Today declared it the winner of the Book of the Year award. And in 2004, Christianity Today, claimed that it had arguably shaped the evangelical world, or at least its institutions, more than any other book published in the last decade. And 2 years ago, in 2022, Erdmans brought out a new and updated printing of the book. So, Mark, Christianity Today and Erdmans Publishing are pretty highly placed players in the evangelical world, and they seem to say that you're on to something that evangelicals need to hear. So I do want to talk about that. But before you say anything, I want to read a couple excerpts from the book to set the stage, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
So here's an excerpt from the opening paragraph of the preface of your book. You wrote, "This book is an epistle from a wounded lover, and as one who is in love with the life of the mind, but who also been drawn to faith in Christ through the love of evangelical Protestants, I find myself in a situation where wounding is commonplace. Although the thought has occurred to me regularly over the past two decades that, at least in the United States, it is simply impossible to be, with integrity, both evangelical and intellectual." And the opening sentence of chapter one is this: "The scandal of the evangelical mind is that there is not much of an evangelical mind." So, Mark, that was 30 years ago. Do you still stand behind those statements?
Well, things do, of course, move on, and I'm probably more aware now than I was then of the limits of my own vision, what I was seeing and what I was reacting to. Certainly then, but even more now, there is a real difficulty in having a concrete understanding of what exactly evangelical means with respect to communities of faith, not just in North America, but around the world. So the book came primarily out of what could be described regionally as Northern American, and then racially white, Baptist, Presbyterian, Conservative Methodist, Bible Church, post-fundamentalist Christianity. It was the groups that were pleased to exchange the term fundamentalist for evangelical. So leaders like Carl Henry, the founding editor of Christianity Today, Billy Graham in his own way. And what certainly has transpired in the decade since the book came out is that evangelical in the United States has become a term mixed up with politics and partisanship, which to me is just disastrous. But it's also, and I think in a much more favorable way, come to speak for communities that were just not as visible when I was writing the book. So I'm impressed today, for example, that the head of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship in the United States and the head of the National Association of Evangelicals in the United States are Asian Americans. I think in both cases, second generation Americans, but people who would not necessarily have been part of what I considered to be, quote unquote, the evangelical world that I was addressing in 1990. I've done quite a bit of historical work since that time on questions of Bible interpretation, especially wrestling with the really knotty issue of why so many Americans, white Americans, before the Civil War thought the Bible sanctioned slavery. And part of that process has been to read a lot of material and to talk with some African-Americans who in what they believe and what they practice are evangelical. So if you think about the characteristics that David Bebington identified, conversion, high authority of the Bible, activism, emphasis upon the cross of Christ, these are evangelical people. And obviously, the history and the presence of African-American evangelicals has been very different from Northern white evangelical, post-fundamentalist evangelicals. So it probably would have been hard for me to write the book today because I'd have spent 100 pages saying, what do we mean? What should we mean by evangelical? And that confusion is magnified around the world because a great deal of world Protestantism and even in many places, world Catholicism would have the characteristics of trusting in the Holy Spirit, valuing the scriptures as supreme authority, being active in evangelism and social outreach, but would have very little to do with some of the characteristics and some of the discriminating points found in North American Christianity. So yes, evangelical, I think, still is a good word if it can be used for those sorts of emphases that came out of the Reformation and were revitalized in the 18th century and continue to have an approach to Christian faith that emphasized personal involvement, usually taking shape in voluntary activities, although strong in many of the more formal denominations also. So what I'm stumbling around to say is that trying to talk about the or even a evangelical mind is probably more difficult than I realized in the early 1990s, and certainly more complicated today than I had thought about then.
Hearing you talk about it, I almost wonder if the challenge of, in a sense, or I don't know if the challenge is the right word, but we want to simplify. We live in an age of sound bites and tweets we want all our information in a couple of minutes, and attention spans are declining, it would seem. And therefore, when we talk about things like evangelicalism and so on, it's a complex subject. And as a historian, yeah. Dr. Noel, you know that more than most people, right? And so it must be frustrating at times when you're in those situations and you're asked, people want to talk about it as evangelicalism, and you know that it's way more complicated than that. You can't just kind of use those terms. They explain less and less all the time, I guess. I guess that's what I'm trying to get at.
I think you're right. When someone says, are you an evangelical? My answer now is, well, what do you mean? If you mean primarily a certain political position, a certain position even on moral issues, then you have to say, well, that's not necessarily the key matter. Historically, evangelicalism has spoken of a way of appropriating and being actively involved in what could be called classical Christian orthodoxy, although the word orthodox is a tricky word too. Things are, I mean, historians are criticized, I think, and probably rightly so, for saying all the time, it's complicated, it's good.
Yeah. Well, they know that it is, you know, right. I guess, unfortunately, you know, there are times when we can simplify, but there are times when, you can't, you know, and everything doesn't come in neat little packages like that. So
maybe at this time, we should talk about where we see this problem of anti-intellectualism. Now, at some point, I'm certainly going to want to talk about how we see this in the way evangelicals interact with science. And I know that Scott has a lot of things to explore when it comes to how they interact with politics. But we see this also in how evangelicals engage with philosophy, with theology, even the arts, especially music. So, Mark, where do you want to begin on where we see the manifestations of this problem?
Today, it seems to me that on almost any serious intellectual question, people identified as evangelical are all over the map, which means that it's either a difficulty in fact or a difficulty in how we use the language. If you say someone's an evangelical, maybe that someone would be identified as a first-order scientist who has a prestigious position in the United States government. That was Francis Collins, head of the National Institute of Health. Or if you say, well, what about legal theory or political history in the United States? And I would think, well, John Witte, a very distinguished historian of law at Emory University, David Skeel, very distinguished legal scholar at the University of Pennsylvania. These are good evangelical people. But by the same token, anybody who's been alert to the popular media, to the internet, knows that on science questions, there's a lot of people known as evangelicals who think the world came into existence 9,000 years ago. And there's a lot of people in political life who do the characteristic American thing to practice the ready, fire, aim approach to difficult problems. So structurally, I think the situation we have now is an ever-increasing sophistication, I would say intellectual sophistication, theological sophistication, and a sophisticated way to think about problems in the world from a Christian angle. We have an ever-growing population of people. Maybe they might not be called evangelical, but they would be Christian. They would be at home with InterVarsity Group, at home with the Veritas Forum, at home publishing with presses like InterVarsity Press or Erdman's. And at the same time, there would be a larger population, in many ways probably still evangelical in some meaningful sense, but who would never heard of these people and who would approach intellectual questions in an entirely different manner. So that a real difficulty in talking about evangelical intellectual life today is that there's a real deep fissure between what might be called, I don't know, university attuned Christian thinkers and actors who have evangelical sympathies, and then the majority of those whom sociologists and political scientists can identify as evangelicals, the majority who really don't care anything about these. And I think from the standpoint of someone who's been a historian, a would-be intellectual, it really shows a difficulty in what people like myself have had in communicating with brothers and sisters in the church. Communicating with fellow academics can sometimes be very contentious. Sometimes Christian people of any sort can be put down for homophobic and medieval and vicious beliefs. But in my view, academically considered, Christian spokespeople today are doing really quite well in that circle. I don't want to paint a too rosy picture. It's not a real renaissance, and certainly there's no danger of Christian voices taking over the university. But the people I've mentioned and many others we could mention know how to operate in that university world, maybe better than we know how to communicate to a broader church Christian population what we've been trying to do with philosophy and science and history and sociology and other academic fields. So I do think there has been improvement in the last decades, and probably there was improvement even when I was writing The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind, where Christian colleges, Christian publishers, academic university presses are bringing out the works and promoting the viewpoints of really knowledgeable, sharp, Orthodox Christian people of evangelical leaning. And there is a real problem of having that kind of insight and worldview and perceptions communicated to a broader evangelical public. It's been a problem for a long time. I don't think I recognize it clearly enough. At 30 years ago, I recognize it now as a major issue.
But if I may, as a scientist, I'll give one example of where I see this problem of anti-intellectualism coming up is I see that in science. I can see it directly in science. Research that goes on in secular scientific institutions, we're moving back the line of the unknown. We're finding things out. And when I look at research that are being done in the evangelical world, I find that the scholarship is really largely apologetic, and they're trying to come up with counter proposals. They're digging through what secular scientists have found, and they're digging around for the exceptions to the rule, and then they dwell on those, and they come up with alternative explanations for these exceptions to the rule. So I'm thinking, for example, of Answers in Genesis, Creation Research International, the Discovery Institute, even some of the ID, the Intelligent Design Research. It's not advancing, pushing back on the unknown. It's just digging around through secular science and looking for paradoxes and the exceptions to the rule. So is that the best science that the evangelical world can produce?
No, I think there are contemporary examples that would say faithful Christian people can contribute. I'm thinking of the BioLogos program, which founded in part by Francis Collins, who I mentioned before, Tim Keller, conservative Presbyterian minister, recently deceased in New York, and a number of similar people who want to have a positive contribution as scientists, and in their minds, do so on the basis of Christian faith, open to the world that God made, using the senses that and the intelligence that God gave the humans to understand that world, but not afraid to find out new things. By contrast, and you mentioned Answers in Genesis, I think we talked about the Ark experience of the place in Kentucky where there's been reconstruction of what's purported to be Noah's Ark. This way of approaching scientific matters, it would be almost in a completely different universe.
Yeah.
Now here I'm going to have to pause and you're going to help me, but there is a really good Canadian climate scientist who teaches.
Oh, Catherine Hayhoe.
Yeah. Catherine Hayhoe is a really interesting example. A person, a Canadian who teaches now at Texas and has actually been in the forefront of trying to explain to popular audiences while also doing some research of her own why climate change is a real fact, a real issue. She stands in the train of several individuals whose names I'm not going to be able to come up with in Britain, who were among the first people to propose scientific research, trying to figure out the dimensions and the difficulties of climate change, who were very faithful Christian believers. I do think just making the reference to Britain does point out the fact that while popular church attendance, religious adherence has dropped more rapidly in Britain than in the United States. There has always been, back to the 18th and 19th century with Lord Kelvin and people like that, a really strong research-producing Christian contingent in the British world of science, which I think we have now today in the United States, but did not for quite some time.
You know, one of the things that to me comes out clearly in what you're saying, Dr. Noel, is this kind of dichotomy, I guess, between there's the popular picture and then there's the academic world, right? And this comes up in the show quite frequently where as I sit and listen to things and hear people describe, quote, evangelicalism in certain ways, I think to myself, yeah, but that may be a type of evangelicalism, but it's not the type I've inhabited for most of my journey. But that doesn't get the press, does it? Like, you don't, you know, those the scientists you just mentioned nobody's heard of her, but everybody's heard of the Answers in Genesis guy, right? That seems to be a real problem here, do you think?
Yes, definitely. And what I would say is another difference from the time when the book first came out is the expansion of social media. You wouldn't maybe know when the internet came into existence, but it certainly wasn't a thing in the early 1990s. And now what has been characteristic of American popular culture, including a lot of American Protestant evangelical culture, is the most effective exploiters of popular media are those who have the biggest people aware of them the most in public life. And in some sense, you have to say, well, you know, it's good that evangelical people tried to exploit the media. So way back in the 18th century, you had George Whitefield preaching in the public square, which was probably a good thing. But when we come to the 21st century and realize that the internet and social media are designed to feature short, pithy, polemical, extreme viewpoint, then you realize that someone who wants to say, well, let's look at A and B, let's think about research that might push us to see. Let's listen to criticism of the point I've just made in the effort to have a good discussion that will lead the critic and myself to something further. That discursive, conversational, dialogic way of reasoning, you know, might work at some TV programs at 11:30 at night, but it's not what people are consuming day in and day out on their smartphones.
Well, you know, it's interesting because when you think about our political discourse, and we want to talk a little bit about that too in a bit, our political discourse now is carried on mostly by comedians. It's Bill Maher. It's, who's the other fellow over?
Stephen Colbert.
Who's
Jimmy Kimmel.
Yeah, all of them, right? And it's entertaining and it's funny, and I get that. But it's not very enlightening, right? You compare that to, you know, the 60s and 70s when you had things like Firing Line with the conservative Bill Buckley, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, yeah. Not very exciting stuff, but they really did kind of they explored issues, you know, and they had debate, and and it was more of an intellectual exercise, where now we've turned everything into entertainment. You know, if it's not entertaining, you can't grab an audience anywhere. So I kind of get it. On the one hand, if I want to be popular on YouTube, it's the game I have to play. But it's I think it's a real problem in our discourse. So on the political side then of the equation, how have things changed, I guess, since you wrote the scandal, and where are we at in our political discourse amongst evangelicals?
Yes, this has obviously been a focus of a huge amount of attention here in the U.S., particularly with the rise of Donald Trump and that pretty tight identification of, at least in the popular view, evangelicals with the Republican Party. My own sense, of course, I have to have a historical view here. I think the difference from 50 years ago is really dramatic. In 1976, when Jimmy Carter was the Democratic presidential nominee against Gerald Ford, the incumbent who'd taken over from Richard Nixon, a majority of people whom the pollsters identify as evangelical voted for Jimmy Carter. At that time, there were very active voices in the Democratic Party, like Ted Kennedy, like Jesse Jackson, who were known as pro-life Democrats, Senator Casey from Pennsylvania. And obviously, over the last 50 years, that kind of situation has changed dramatically. Now, also of note is the fact that throughout the last 40 or 50 years, the percentage of Black churchgoers, most of whom in some general sense would be evangelical, has remained astronomically high for Democratic candidates. So we have the anomaly for religious historians of evangelicalism, that the two groups that come closest to practicing the characteristics that David Bevington identifies as evangelicalism stand at polar opposites in the American political landscape, with a huge majority of white so-called evangelicals for the Republicans, a huge majority of the Black so-called evangelicals for the Democrats. Now, why has this happened? I mean, we can't get into all the detail, but clearly the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s with the rapidly shifting public attitudes toward sex and family have had a divisive effect. And then the media have given platforms to those who have pushed to the extremes. So I think we live in a situation now where public discourse has become so muddled that some researchers, some pollsters have discovered that at least a significant minority of people who now want to be called evangelicals, who tell researchers they're evangelicals, never go to church because their sense of what it means to be an evangelical means to support the Republican candidate.
Right, yeah.
And there are several of people who are themselves politically conservative, who would not at all be in favor of some of the major planks in a Democratic Party platform, who nonetheless are just appalled at the use of a term that comes out of a very specific way of being and doing Christianity applied to partisan politics. I'm thinking particularly of a really fine book by Thomas Kidd, formerly of Baylor University, now of the seminary, Southern Baptist Seminary in Kansas City, writing for Yale University Press about what is evangelicalism and trying himself as a theologically conservative, and I think maybe even politically conservative Christian, saying it's just a misuse to amalgamate evangelical as a category with a certain variety of partisan political activity. One of the things that I've really enjoyed about getting to know Canadian history is to find a few people. A late historian friend of mine, George Rolick, was a serious Baptist. He was a sponsor of InterVarsity and comparable groups at the universities he taught. And he was a dedicated member of the New Democratic Party. He was a socialist. And it was always fun talking to George because you just didn't get to talk to too many Baptist socialists in the United States. So I think what has unfortunately taken place is that terms that really need to be used in a narrow, more strictly defined religious sense have wandered, and in the wandering, a great confusion takes place.
Mark, what do you think is behind the evangelicals shunning intellectualism. Again, I'm thinking science. We've been talking about politics. We didn't really talk about the theology or the culture for that matter. But why are evangelicals seeming to shun intellectualism?
Yes, again, that's a really important question, a big question. I can speak out of my own research, which is far from the whole picture. I've been working for decades now on how the Bible has been put to use in American public life. And clearly, in the 19th century, there were things that took place that continue to have an impact for today. And just to mention one of the least complicated ones, toward the end of the 19th century, mainstream American universities began to feature professors, write books that called into question traditional views about the authority of the Bible. The reaction in actually moderate as well as conservative Protestant circles, later Catholic circles, was to say, no, the Bible is God's revelation. The Bible is true in what it reports about supernatural events. But as the university world continued on in moving away from what had been in the 19th century, something like a Christian consensus, then there was more and more anguished rebuttals and retreats among at least some Protestant groups. And in those Protestant groups, nervousness about university learning because of how the Bible had been displaced in the universities spread to nervousness about university learning in general. So if in the same university you have people who are saying, well, the Bible just is the record of ancient people's religious experience, and we need to find organic evolutionary explanations for the rise of species, and we're going to do certain things in sociology and certain things in thinking about problems that need to be solved by the exercise of government, then what had begun as a suspicion of university learning concerning the scriptures is very easy to transfer to suspicion about university learning concerning other things. So so-and-so is not a believer, so-and-so doesn't trust the Bible, so what so-and-so says about X, Y, or Z must be suspect as well. I think that's at least one of the factors that lies in the background for the situation we have today.
You also suggested that there's scriptures themselves, passages in the Bible that seem to mock intellectualism or praise simplicity. They refer to the foolishness of man or the foolishness of the wise coming to God as a child. I also wondered about, I think you talked about the passages that refer to the priesthood of all believers. All believers can be their own priest, their own expert. Is this also, the scripture itself seems to be creating the problem?
Yes, well, certainly the way in which the Bible is put to use. Now, I do think this story is complicated. Here, you have to forgive me, because if you study something for decades, you just end up with a complicated story. The United States was different, and I think Canada was sort of halfway between Europe and the United States was a little bit different. In rejecting licensed inherited authority for political life, so the United States throws off the king, throws off aristocracy. And how is the civilization going to develop? It's going to develop on republican, which meaning ground level up, virtue, as individuals take responsibility for doing what had been previously the purview of the elites. Well, in my view, there were problems, but there were some good things. And in the Christian world, it meant that very influential Christian leaders, rather than relying upon someone telling them what to do, just got out and did it. So I'm a Presbyterian fan of the Methodists. The Methodists in the United States and Canada to an extensive degree also, just went out and preached the gospel, organized small groups for improving and sanctification. And the United States stayed out of politics for a long time. And the result was the most vibrant, most rapidly expanding Christian presence anywhere in the world in the first half of the 19th century. So you have this situation that has quite a few positive results, but it also means that if you have a religious movement where it's ordinary, inspired, spirit-driven men and eventually women who are the most important thing for driving religious life, then that becomes the default way of approaching everything. Colleges are slow to start in the United States, and they're not very well funded. And when universities begin to adopt European models, there's a great deal of interest in that. But then there's also nervousness because we're getting away from this bottom-up democratic approach to life in general. My friend Nathan Hatch published a book, The Democratization of American Christianity, and I think he ended ambiguous because he said there really was a tremendous advantage in having a gospel message aimed at, delivered by, accepted by ordinary people. Then, for some task, like patient, detailed, dialogical, intellectual life, that really was not the best way forward. So you had a situation where the strength of a more democratic, bottom-up Christianity could accomplish a lot of good, but in the intellectual sphere, where other characteristics, other strengths are important, the results just were not so propitious, especially when we get to the late 19th century and early 20th century, when specialization and sophistication is needed to live in that academic world.
Yeah, that book by Nathan Hatch is an excellent book. I read a number of years ago. I found it fascinating to, because he kind of flips the script there. We often think of religion's influence on politics, and he's kind of saying, no, you know, democracy had a big influence on religion, right. You know? And in a sense, if I could sum it up, maybe you could say if you agree or not, that in a lot of ways, you know, religion in the U.S. and Canada really is populist. Yeah. It's a very populist thing, whereas in Europe, religion is not so populist. You know, it's run by huge institutions: the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church, the Reformed Church, and you have a populism that exists kind of underneath that. But in Canada, in North America, the populism is at the forefront. It tends to be.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
But I mean, what it means, positively, I think with the Methodists, it was a great burst of Christian vitality. With the Baptists, who spread more rapidly in the United States than anywhere else, there was a great burst of Christian, serious Christian living. Pentecostalism early in the 20th century brought attention to the Holy Spirit that probably had been neglected over time. And all these movements had positive impacts. Seeker-sensitive churches, which... kind of hard for Presbyterians to really talk about too kindly, but seeker-sensitive churches were meeting a need and going out to people where they were. And yet, in every case, what was a strength in some portions of life turned out to be a weakness in those parts of life where, again, you needed preparation, you needed training, you needed to have communication that was not simplified. You need to have discourse that could be checked and countered and debated. And those kind of traits that I think almost everyone would say, well, they're part of what it means to embrace fully what it means to live, what things mean in the world. Those traits had not been part of, and populism is a good word, part of the populist tradition of many of the churches in North America.
Do you think that the pietist strand, like from my limited understanding and a few courses I've taken over the years, that evangelicalism in the 18th century was kind of the combination of this, you know, pietist river converging with the Reformation and so on, that pietist strain is still pretty, you know, that idea of heart religion, right? And the idea that it's not good enough to be Christian. Jesus has to be your personal savior, right?
Right, exactly.
There's this strong pietist. Is that a part of the
antiquity? Yeah, it is. It is. And again, I would say the same thing about as some of these other movements. In many ways, that was a real gift to the church because formal religion, formal Christianity is less, in my view, that what the Christian faith really entails. But by the same token, the heart religion and trusting in the heart is not the whole story. So my own sense of ideal Christian movements are those that are formal and have some kind of structure and that have a pietistic element. So I've been, for a number of different reasons, I've been working on the life of J.S. Bach recently and reading a lot of him and listening. And here's someone supported by a state church, dependent upon the goodwill of kings and electors and town councils, and yet who uses themes from some of the pietists of his day that the formal church people just abominated. So he infused what was formal and traditional and hereditary with pietistic elements. And that seems to me, that was John Wesley's ideal also, that the Church of England needed to have a heart. Things eventually led to the separation of the Methodists, but that was his goal. I think that's a very good goal, but it's keeping together the different parts that can be seen as quite important in Christian life. So the head and the heart, thinking and doing. Christian faith should be broad and deep and not simply focused on any one particular thing.
I've had a lifelong interest in Jonathan Edwards, and it almost seems that he's the perfect example of those two things converging and, in a sense, conflicting. I see him as a conflicted man as well, right?
Where, yes, I think you're right.
He struggles with that, but he's a giant intellect, but he's also a pietist. And of course, he's accused of being an enthusiast, you know, as they used to say in those days.
Another great book that I'm sure you know about is George Morrison's biography of Jonathan Edwards. And he shows that Edwards did try to keep those things together, but it also, quite realistically, I mean, there's a man who's certainly the most important religious thinker in the Protestant world, and maybe the most important philosopher in America in the 18th century, and he's kicked out of his own church, you know?
Yeah.
So he can't be successful with the group that he's called upon to minister to. That's a really hard story to wrap your mind around.
Yeah, and paradoxically, he becomes known mostly in the popular world as the guy who preached, you know, sinners in the hands of an angry God, which was so kind of atypical for him, but it does demonstrate that there was that side to his.
Definitely.
Yeah, and the guy in modern times that I also think of is the Fuller professor, E.J. Carnell, who I read quite a bit when I was younger, and same thing there. You know, he was this giant intellect, but he's kind of an interesting person because I believe Harper published a book by him. Mm-hmm. And this just kind of to show how things have changed, right? Harper published a book by him, and that was a big deal for a secular press to publish a book by an evangelical was seen to be like a huge breakthrough. Whereas now, of course, you know, Harper has a whole division. Right. You know, well, I think Harper owns Zondervan, don't they? Or I believe, or something.
Well, but anyway. Yes, I mean, again, you're drawing attention to the, what is at least a twofold world. So I'm not a philosopher, but I'm aware that in the last 25 and 30 years, the Oxford University Press and Cornell University Press have published, dozens of works by serious Christian philosophers that often use very careful analytical reasoning to talk about things like the atonement, the Trinity,
right,
the person of Christ. And this would have been unimaginable in the 1940s and 50s. So we have, at one level, a really sophisticated philosophical, not just defense, but approach to Christian faith. But then on the popular level, there's a billion books sold that have a really, I don't use demeaning language, but a really shaky view of end times. So both of those things are coexisting.
Yeah.
So Dr. Newell, at this point, we have been talking about this scandal of the evangelical mind in the past and to some extent leading up to the present, but I want to talk now about the future. And I'm realizing that we actually need to talk about two different perspectives on the future. Your perspective on the future 30 years ago, when you wrote this book, and you were at that time, 30 years ago, looking forward into the future. And then, well, let me just read something from your book before I go to the next point. On page 228, in a chapter with the title, "Is an Evangelical Renaissance Underway?" you concluded with this statement: "In some, evangelical reflection is not now a torrent, but it is more than a cloud the size of a man's hand." Now, it struck me that many of your readers, and probably many in our audience, will probably have no idea what this reference to a cloud the size of a man's hand means. Maybe you want to tell the story of where this strange phrase comes from, but more importantly, did the drought, not Elijah's three-year-long drought in ancient Israel, but the drought of evangelical thinking in 20th century North America, did that turn into a downpour of renewed intellectualism? Have evangelicals made any progress in the 30 years since you wrote that book?
Yes, the reference is to the story of Elijah, who is told by the Lord to confront the prophets of Baal, that they're defeated, but yet there's still drought in the land. And he goes to tell his servant, well, check out the sky and tell me what you see. And eventually comes back and sees there's a cloud the size of a man's hand. So then you better hustle to get some shelter. Yes, I think over the last 30 and 40 years, there have been a quickening of really serious intellectual work by Christian people in the North American part of the world. So in that sense, what I was hoping for then and what I think I could see that was already sort of underway has continued. We mentioned some of the figures, the BioLogos, the Christian legal scholars, the historians like George Marsden and Nathan Hatch, and there's a lot of their students and people who followed in their train continue their good work. I think what I didn't anticipate is what we talked about before, that for a vigorous intellectual kind of Christianity, there needed to be more than just life in the upper regions, but somehow to be translated to the populace at large. I don't think that has been done so successfully.
Having attended a seminary myself, and Scott did as well, I remember so many times what was being taught to us students in the seminary was not the scholarly version, but more what would sell in the churches. And so professors were trying to water things down for the pastors in the class, and those pastors in turn are going to water it down because they need to speak to the people who support the church, donations, either donations to the church or donations to the seminary. So is that part of the issue there?
Yes, I think certainly what I did not see as clearly as I should have is that intellectual problems, intellectual issues are never just intellectual. So the framework, the context within which thinking goes on, the institutions that either support or detract from strong intellectual life, the forces from the broader society. Again, Scott mentioned E.J. Carnell as a pioneer of working at trying to bridge the gap between what it was then a fundamentalist world and the more academic world. Carnell published the book in the early 1950s. I don't think it was a real good book necessarily, and certainly didn't get much attention, but it was on television. Well, you say, yes, well, what's television have to do with good theology? And in one way, it's nothing. But if you think, well, the world in which people are trying to do good theology is going to be influenced by this new medium that pretty soon is going to be in everybody's home, and pretty soon you're going to have church musicians say, well, if we're going to have something that attracts people by the singing and music in our church, it's got to look like something almost as good as on TV, on the Lawrence Welk Show or Ed Sullivan. So Carnell was perceptive. He was seeing that what he was trying to do as a theologian, a kind of ethicist, a philosophical theologian, had a real clear intellectual dimension, but also had a not quite so clear future in the broader context of American life. And one of the reasons why I'm a Reformed believer and a great fan of Abraham Kuyper, the philosopher, newspaper politician from the Netherlands, is that he conceived of Christian life as taking in all the spheres of life. And whether or not he was right in how he put things together is a good question. He certainly couldn't have been all correct. But what I think Kuyper's vision of Christian faith included was the belief that personal sanctification, evangelism, missionary activity, growth in grace was at the heart, the foundation of what it meant to be Christian, but so did also having a perspective on the political world, having a perspective on economic questions, having a perspective on war and peace, the things that impact believers and everybody else. And so whether or not he got the details right, his broad conception of what it meant to live for God in the world definitely included very strongly evangelical elements, but also then was concerned about the broader picture of life in society, life in an economy, life in an educational realm. And that perspective was one that was pretty much lacking, I think, in the broader, I'm going to say the broader Christian world. I think maybe there were a few Catholics and maybe a few Protestant leaders that were thinking in those terms, but not very many. And I think what we've been talking about today a lot is how influences that we don't think of as religion have a tremendous impact on religious life in North American societies.
Mm-hmm.
So the question that we're dealing with is, why is this scholarly activity, this intellectualism, not trickling down to the people in the pews? And I asked if it had to do with funding. But another thing that I see a lot of, another thing that's contributing to that, I think, is leaders who do speak out, who try to present these alternative views, and they end up they lose their positions. The first one that comes to mind is Peter Enns. So many people who have been fired simply because they said, you know what, I think I see things differently here. And so there's that tendency in evangelical circles to get rid of the people who are raising these new ideas. You want to speak to that, Mark?
Yes. I have more sympathy now as an old person for people who try to maintain institutions. And the real contribution of institutions is providing stability, longevity. The real challenge for institutional leaders is, how do you keep going with dialogue, consideration of new ideas, without being afraid, without losing your donors, I agree. I think individual cases are different, but there has been an institutional protectiveness, some of which is natural and good, some of which probably has gone too far. I think in these, the kind of cases that we can think of, is probably each one is different for different reasons. Christian institutions have, I think, a responsibility and a privilege of setting boundaries, but they also should have a double measure of wisdom in knowing how to enforce the boundaries. That kind of wisdom is so difficult that it's made me glad that I mostly was lecturing in the classroom and going to the library to do my studies and not trying to run an institution. It's a very challenging job.
Do you think that at an institutional level or at a research level, I think the goal is to pursue the truth wherever it leads?
Yeah.
Now, when you have a confessional-based academic institution, is that really the goal, to pursue the truth wherever it leads? Or is it to support that particular confession?
That is a good question. I think ideally one looks at examples and says, well, the instantiations of the main Christian creeds have been good places for academic life with some issues. I don't think Thomas Aquinas was nervous about having to be a faithful Catholic. Jonathan Edwards was not nervous about having to uphold Reformed theology in the 18th century. But yes, there's great reward in having a clear confession, but then the confession needs to be checked and worked at and made sure that it's not excessive. I think one of the difficulties in American history was that the strongly evangelical and pietistic groups came to a greater clarity in their own minds about things that might not have been too important. For a long, long time, a lot of Christian institutions were teetotal. Well, moderation and opposition to alcoholism is a very good thing. But whether making that a kind of central part of your boundary making may not have been such a good idea, particularly when you have a scriptures where it's very hard to find that kind of that approach to life. What I'm trying to say, I think, is that confessional boundaries can be a very positive thing, but not if they take on a life of their own and are unconnected to rooting in foundational Christian teaching.
And, you know, even secular institutions struggle with this because, you know, they're not confessional in the sense of religion, but they are confessional in the sense of certain liberal values, right? So if you look what's going on in the U.S. right now, you know, this huge outpouring, and these, you know, the very institutions that are saying they're all about free speech and they're all about dialogue and all that are having a pretty tough time with this particular free speech.
Right? Exactly. Yes. The difference between confessional institutions and those without a confession is much, much less, just because informal rules have the same effect. Exactly.
Yeah. Maybe they're more insidious in some ways.
Can be.
Yeah.
Now, at the risk of repeating what we've danced around a little bit earlier in this conversation, I said that we needed to look at two perspectives on the future, one of which was you 30 years ago looking at the future when you wrote this book and have your predictions played out. But then the second perspective would be the three of us now and our listeners right now looking into the future. What's your perspective on that? Is it optimistic or pessimistic?
I'm actually fairly optimistic about the continuation of serious intellectual work by serious Christian people. I think a challenge for such people is to do more at communicating what they're doing in the intellectual spheres with the public at large. I'm probably not optimistic about the effects of continued mass media, social media. I think those are very difficult forces to overcome. In my view, strengthening local churches is a very important matter, although I'm not sure I have a formula how that can be done. So on the narrow intellectual plane, I'm actually fairly confident there'll be continued to be good work. We have a number of really promising signs in the last, even while colleges and universities struggle with enrollments and finances, we've had a number of Christian study centers established at universities, private universities and public universities that are do a terrific job. I mentioned the Veritas Forum earlier, a really impressive effort to bring together serious academics who are serious Christians and to present their work in the public sphere. And there are many things like this, but there are also the ongoing tsunami of social media distraction.
Right.
And that's is a real issue. We saw during the pandemic when efforts by local church leaders to protect and organize their congregations were sometimes badly damaged by external forces, making polemical matters out of, you know, and making scapegoats out of people who are just trying to do the right thing. So, yeah, I guess I'm a reformed Christian, so I have to be positive on some things, but negative about human nature.
Mark, as we come to the end of this conversation, there may be something that we haven't covered that you would think needs to be put on the table. Is there anything that we haven't covered that you would like to conclude with or otherwise summarize with?
Well, I think I'd like to reiterate my sense as an academic and someone who believes the life of the mind can be a really important arena of service for God. I'm just hoping that future generations of people who think like I do keep working hard at the intellectual task, but then also think more about how life in a local congregation, communication to the broader public, maybe even, God forbid, positive Christian use of the internet might in some way bring some of the fruit that is being harvested in intellectual spheres to bring that fruit to as nourishment to broader parts of the Christian community. That would be my hope.
And if I can plug, I think that's what podcasts, they are one of the vehicles by which that's going to happen. And not just ours, there's lots of great podcasts out there. So
you're a historian who's also living and has lived through some really important periods of you know, pivoting kind of periods of history in the U.S. And one of them certainly that's happening right now, and that is kind of the morphing of evangelicalism, to use the term, into a populist political movement. I don't know if you want to comment on that or...
I would say that what happens to the way people think about evangelicals or evangelicalism is an issue, but that's not the most important issue. I think the most important issue is not names and categories, but faithfulness to God, faithfulness to the gospel, and whatever it's called. You just hope that that kind of Christian faith will prevail and not be distracted too much by debates over who is or who is not a true evangelical. The word, in my view, the word really is in trouble, but that doesn't bother me too much because evangelicalism at its best, or evangelical people acting at their best, are those who are not protective of the term, but want to have a particular impact in the world as they seek to follow Christ. And that's the important thing.
Well, Mark, I want to again thank you for giving us your time. It was very valuable, your expertise, your perspective on history. I want to say again to our listeners that this book of Dr. Noel, The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind, it's a must read if you're interested in the history and sociology behind Christianity in North America. It's still worth reading even 30 years later. And again, Erdmans did a republishing of this only 2 years ago, so they see that as well. Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's my privilege to be speaking with you.
Yes, thank you very much.
You've been listening to Recovering Evangelicals with your hosts, Luke Jansen and Scott Dyer. Send your comments and suggestions for new episodes to lukejjampson@gmail.com. Join our private discussion group on Facebook by searching for the Recovering Evangelicals podcast group. Look for the logo that you always see at your favorite podcast catcher and ask to be let in. Subscribe to lukejjampson.wordpress.com if you want to get advanced releases and group posts. Or browse through our archive for a full listing of all our previous episodes. And please help the podcast by sharing with a friend and leaving a review at your favorite podcast catcher.